Christian, did you know that there's a law firm part-owned by a recruitment agency?
I did not.
And did you know that there is one that actually caps lawyers' bonuses to disincentivise them from working too hard?
Again, no, I didn't.
And did you know that there's a law firm run not by a lawyer but by an engineer?
Well, is this just an exercise in exposing my lack of legal trivia knowledge? Because it's not fair.
I promise these are not just quiz questions. They are great facts about some of the lesser-known law firms in the UK, and this is all part of the lawyer's new strand, Beyond the Bubble, focusing on what's going on outside the top 50, both in the regions and in London. Launching soon, it's going to be led by the wonderful Richard Simmons and Jess Boak, and we'll be explaining why this set of firms has so much to add to the national discussion later in the podcast when Rich comes along and tells us more about it.
Well, speaking of podcasts, I think we should probably say welcome to the Lawyer Podcast. I'm Christian Smith, litigation editor of The Lawyer.
And I'm Katrin Griffiths, editor of The Lawyer.
Also on this episode, we're going to talk about that Paul Hastings memo and why it's divided not only much of the legal profession, but also the lawyer's newsroom.
But first, it's April. And with a financial year end, the lawyer has been taking a look at a range of economic health issues for firms across the country.
But while many of the traditional financial institutions are nervously watching their pennies, and the IMF predicts, well, gloom, if perhaps not doom, for the UK economy, litigation funders are, as always, chipper.
Yes, because several litigation funders appear determined to become banks for the legal industry, as our director of Insight, Matt Byrne, can reveal.
Hello.
Why is this happening now? What is going? Just give us a quick tour of the situation right now.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of these funders have been around for a while, and obviously their primary market has been funding single cases. Then it grows into numerous cases, portfolios of cases, and it is expanded from there. So what's really happened is, there are a few funders in the market who are active on a variety of products, but one in particular, a sort of broken cover, and that's Harbour, as being a funder, or at least trying to position itself as a funder for the business of law and not just litigation. So they are being explicit and specific about building on the relationships they've built with firms for single cases, and now saying, look, we've got some money. You've got some projects you want to do. Is there anything we can maybe do together? And it doesn't have to be linked to litigation at all. It can be, you know, funding a department's growth or laterals or anything at all.
But these funders have had deep pockets. They're, you know, they're well known for having deep pockets. They've been in this market for quite a while. Why now? What is it now? I referenced the end of the financial year. Talk us through a little bit about the tax changes and why there's a sort of more systemic shift in the way that law firms are looking at their how they're capitalised and so on.
Well, there's a few things there to unpick. Why now for the funders is that it actually spreads a bit of risk for them. So rather than looking at a single litigation case with a what you call a binary outcome, they're monetizing these relationships with funders in different ways, smoothing some of the revenues as well, you know, if they're getting an interest rate payment. For the firms, you know, I think firms are starting to think and have been thinking about themselves in more sophisticated ways for quite a while now. I mean, obviously, we've seen firms list. We've seen firms now have equity stakes taken in them, and Burford was one of the first to do that. So the drivers for the firms are quite varied. It depends on where they sit in the market. Often you're looking at firms that are just starting up. They don't have a track record as a new firm. So the banks themselves, they won't lend to them. They can't get the money. Whereas these funders who know the market, the legal market really well, can say, look, we know you guys. We can take a bit more of a punt on you. And we can lend this money to you, and we can do it in several ways.
So there's a sort of a jigsaw, isn't there, of factors here, of motivations about, you know, why firms would be looking even sort of taking the litigation funders' calls, aren't there? Sort of, what are the options currently for firms to, I suppose, diversify their capital base, to really understand and actually make their cash flow a little bit more workable and so on, Matt?
Pretty straightforward, actually, Kat. I mean, you either increase partner capital and you may see capital calls. I'll come onto that in a second, actually. There's a reason why we may see capital calls over the next few months. You borrow more, or you get money in from the clients more quickly. You get your bills out and get your the cash collected. So there is a real push on lockup. There has been for years. But I think one of the things that's happening now at the moment is this HMRC basis period reform that means that, without going too deeply into the weeds there, it means that on January 25, every firm is going to have to pay more tax that year. There's an acceleration of the tax. There's sort of a truncation of the period in which profits are paid. And the upshot of this means that firms are going to have to find more cash in January. You can spread it, but they are going to have to find it. And so some firms, depending on their cash flow, depending on the market they're in, will be looking around for different sources of capital. And I think that is one of the things that these funders are tapping into. Particularly, you know, Harbour is saying, look, we're not just going to be about litigation funding. We've got money and we're going to be there. If you do need to fund working capital, we can do that. And going to the banks might not be an option, because they may just say, look, we don't want to take a punt on that.
But surely, I mean, why would a firm go to a litigation funder when, I mean, it's really obvious that they're going to be much more expensive than the banks, because they're offering very flexible funding, probably sort of quicker, more short-term funding and so on. I mean, is this really a long-term option for major partnerships? I mean, partnerships are very risk-averse. They don't even like going in. They don't like debt much anyway. Do you think that there will be a groundswell of interest and take-up?
I think, yeah, surely, certainly getting consensus in a big partnership is always difficult. For big firms, maybe, you know, the really well-capitalized firms might not need it. One of the things we just did for our City Signal report was look at the level of cash at some of the top city firms. And there are hundreds of millions, you know. Some of the firms have really grown their cash pile, at least at the year end, you know, by significant double digits. I'm thinking Addleshaw's, the Magic Circle, all have it. Linklaters actually has gone down significantly. But there are reasons for that, you know, to be fair. The pandemic is the key one. But
We've all been through the pandemic, as have other folks. I mean, that's not...
My cash levels are pretty low.
But if a firm starts talking about the pandemic for reasons, strategic reasons now, that's a pretty threadbare excuse.
I think the thing that these funders are aiming at the moment is not the likes of Linklaters and A&O and Clifford Chance or the top 50. They are really looking at partners who may be at some of those firms, but they're spinning out and looking to launch boutiques or smaller firms that may not be, a litigation boutique, but will be looking for funding. And I think that's really where they're targeting their efforts. I know that there are Harbour is fairly clear that they've got a couple of deals in the pipeline. They're probably fairly small, let's say, sub 10 million. So you're certainly not talking Magic Circle level or top 50 level. But if it catches on as a way of funding growth in a department or for a particular reason, then that market could really take off.
And I know that other firms, other litigation funders, it's not just Harbour. I know Burford has been involved in part funding a couple of startup law firms. I mean, and there's sort of issues around, you know, they're taking equity stakes as well. So there's a panoply of kind of, you know, approaches, I think.
I mean, is this the start of seeing litigation funders being much more than litigation funders and, I suppose, now investors in firms? I mean, is this the start of a new financial institution?
The way that they would say it is that the legal sector and law firms are way behind the pace in terms of the way that these businesses are financed. They are, as one described it, they're a piggy bank, basically. It's incredibly unsophisticated. It's still the full distribution model, notwithstanding what I said earlier about the cash levels rising. Generally, partners want their money as soon as they can get it. And the partnership structure disincentivizes firms from holding back money for investment. So there is an opportunity there for certain types of firms to access this funding at a time when I think some firms are also looking at becoming a little bit more sophisticated in the way that they're financed.
I don't know. I don't think there's anything wrong with being unsophisticated, if that's what unsophisticated is. I mean, these are huge global organizations that are sophisticated in the way they run all of their processes. Just because they don't go for fancy financial engineering. I mean, there, some firms tried to list. You name me a really outstanding, successful listed firm, and that's supposed to be a sophisticated way of accessing capital and so on. You know, fundamentally, City investors don't really understand law firms, and they don't really understand actually what a good practice is and what have you. And they're often bamboozled by the idea of growth, where we feel that, you know, that in, for example, there are some firms that are growing, but not in terms of adding to their quality on the, in the listed sector. So I don't know. I'm a skeptic on this, Matt, I have to say. But I think, you know, you've done some incredible work pointing out all of the opportunities for all of these funders. What's your prognosis for the next couple of years? Do you think they're really going to hoover up, particularly on the sort of the smaller side?
Smaller firms, yeah, I do. I think that you're going to see, you know, 5 to 10 million, maybe that kind of size of firms accessing this kind of capital. I think the funders I've been speaking to are very much going for this market, and they certainly believe that there's opportunity.
And I think anyone who's a partner or who wants to be a partner should be watching this really closely, because it'll be their money, it'll be your money that, you know, that you're talking about. And actually,
and they'll want a return.
Absolutely,
it's not cheap money at all. So no. You know, they want a return on this.
Absolutely.
Well, Matt, thank you very much. And if you want to learn more, you can read Matt's piece in The Lawyer next week.
Now, the legal world was in a spin over the Easter weekend, thanks to a leaked presentation to associates from the US arm of Paul Hastings.
Yeah, the instructions set out expectations on junior associates. Some of the highlights included Paul Hastings is an AM20 law firm. You're in the big leagues, which is a privilege, so act like it.
You are online 24/7, no exceptions, no excuses.
Yeah, appropriate emphasis, I think. Thank you. No questions until you've tried to figure out something for yourself. So Google unfamiliar concepts, search the DMS, read statutes, still can't figure out the answer, then talk to your classmates.
I think that's quite a good piece of advice. Anyway, and also, I don't know is never an acceptable answer.
So yeah, there are, you know, several other points. There were 10 points on this slide of the presentation. But our in-house reporter and former lawyer Lucy Cruz has been covering the story.
Lucy, why has this created such a stir? As if we didn't know.
I think that the main reason it's caused quite a stir is that people were not impressed with the tone of it, especially around the "you are online 24/7, no exceptions, no excuses." The general sort of feedback, especially on LinkedIn, was that people were really unimpressed and thought that that just contributed to bad mental health, actually poor practice among lawyers in different firms, and that that was something that they'd been striving to change, and that this was just evidence that things had not yet changed.
Mm. But there's not, actually, I mean, there's some really good points in this memo. You know, there's this whole sort of pointing out, presumably to new associates, that, you know, someone is paying $850 an hour for your time. I mean, that's a very, very important reminder that you are a service industry. I mean, you may not be, as the member pointed out, be at the Four Seasons, but it's a similar kind of setup. Is it just the tone that people are objecting to, not the substance?
I think it's this whole idea of ownership that's coming across from it, in that people very much see it just as another way of saying, we own you, we own your time, we own your life. Mm. And obviously there is the whole issue with the fact that they are paying these big bucks to very junior associates. But the uproar is around whether it really is sustainable, considering reports have come out saying that mental health in law firms is so low.
I have to say that it reads very much like someone on very little sleep. Incredibly irritable, setting out some of the key points, which in itself is probably shows you the sort of the lack of rest that a lot of these people get. Christian, you, however, you are as always a skeptic. You're also a former lawyer like Lucy. You've worked in the trenches. You think quite a lot of this is, you know, fair enough, don't you?
I actually think if you're going to work at a big firm, particularly a US firm like Paul Hastings, this is what is going to be expected of you. I think it's fair enough to set it out. And I think if you don't like it, you don't necessarily have to work there. I mean, perhaps the most outrageous thing on there is this claim of you're online 24/7. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that that's an exaggeration, in the sense that, you know, it's unlikely that they expect you to answer an email in 5 minutes at 3 a.m. when you're meant to be asleep. But putting that to one side, it is a privilege, I think, to work at a place like that. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who would like your job. You are charging out to someone at $850 an hour. You know, I think it's okay to set these high expectations. And when it comes to this question of ownership, that is perhaps a bit dodgy. And I think it then comes down to sort of what the reciprocation is on the other side from the seniors to the juniors is, you know, it's not an excuse for seniors to treat juniors like dirt. It's not an excuse for them to kind of not care about them or not engage with them as a human being, that sort of thing. It's a two-way street. But this is what we're looking at here really is purely talking about from the perspective of what the expectation is on the juniors. Mm. And I think in that way, you know, actually it's okay.
I predict that this will do Paul Hastings no harm in the long run. We, you know, there's a lot of comment, and Lucy, I'd like to hear in a minute from sort of some of the reactions from people. There's a lot of comment on how terrible this is, but actually, this will probably make quite a few very ambitious associates going, do you know what? This sounds like a hardworking kind of place, and they will equate riches and financial security with that. You know, I remember running a poll amongst our readers about 5 or 6 years ago about the firm that they would least like to work in, the firm they would most like to work with, and Kirtland came top of both of those. Mm. So I think that there's a sort of, you know, I really, really feel that people are probably overstating their opposition to this. But also there's a sense of tone, coming back to the tone, you know, business language it divides really clearly into two. It's this awful sort of sub-apprentice kind of nonsense that you get, this where the tone is all about rah, 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 you know, kill the oppo and all that kind of stuff. Or you get the, you know, cloying, terrible sort of LinkedIn hashtag learnings kind of post as well. No one ever seems to have a middle ground about sort of, this is just how you're supposed to act. So I'm just wondering how, you know, someone, whoever wrote this is tired and has been watching too many films, usually set in the 80s. Lucy, when you're looking at the reaction online to and indeed all of your contacts sort of at the sort of more junior end of the profession, what's been their response to this?
Some people agree with Christian that this is just what's expected of people going into those law firms, that, you know, you sign up for what you expect. I did, however, see another comment from someone saying that they felt that it wasn't a privilege. It should be treated as a transaction. Mm-hmm. And that at the end of the day, you know, you go in there to take what you want from them, whether that's the salary, the learning experiences, the challenging work, and they'll also do the same with you. It's about what you can give them. And then if it's not for you, then you get out type thing. So I probably would agree with that sentiment, where it's not a privilege, because that sort of incites that you should be grateful and want to work every hour for them and give up your life for them. Whereas actually understanding it as sort of a transaction means that it is that two-way street, which I think is important to remember.
And I think then there's a sort of bifurcation of firms here as well. It's the firms that are, you know, the firms, you know, where it is this absolute understanding that it's a transaction. There's other firms that are, I wouldn't want to call them lifestyle firms, because that's a little bit derogatory, actually. It's become a derogatory term. But firms which are outside this extraordinary bubble of high earnings and high hours billed and so on. And actually, to that end, we have Richard Simmons with us.
Rich, as we flagged earlier on the podcast, we're about to launch this thing called Beyond the Bubble. And I think probably best place to start is, what is it?
I'm glad you asked, Christian, because Beyond the Bubble is going to cover every firm and everything that goes on outside the UK top 50. And frankly, let's be honest, the UK top 50 is boring, isn't it? Boring, boring, boring. Oh, look, I'm Linklaters. I've done another £1 billion deal. Don't care. Don't care.
You're really talking us all out of a job here.
Can I just say the point for our Linklaters listeners, we love you very much.
I know we love all our top 50 firms a lot, but there is an immense amount going on outside the top 50 and the big US firms. It's a much, much less stable tier of the market. There's a lot of stuff really happening among firms, right from the London boutiques out to the new regional powerhouses that are emerging, little mini boutique firms, divorce shops, real estate firms, the consolidators that are in the market, the dispersed firms, the listed firms, an immense diversity of types of organization. And there's really so many stories going on there. And that's why Jess Bokar, our valued colleague, and I are launching this strand called Beyond the Bubble, just to look in more depth at what's going on there.
And I think it's really needed as well, actually, Rich, because I mean, you know, I so many times sort of, you know, you talk to people who are really stuck in the city grind and they don't really know where to look and they don't really understand the rest of the market. And I think this is going to be really, really helpful, both for strategists, you know, obviously, you know, if you want to sort of maybe there's lots of merger activity and consolidation, but also if you're just an ordinary soul wanting to move and actually kind of understanding what your options are and actually the context in which these firms are operating.
Completely so, because there are, you know, on a purely strategic point of view and career point of view, there are huge success stories in the mid-market. But there are also a lot of zombie firms out there too, just sort of staggering along until they're going to be taken over by a larger firm and you just find yourself back where you started.
It's important to mention as well, though, it's not just a regional thing rehashed, is it? It's actually London as well as the regions. It's basically any firm that's not in the top 50.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, there are an incredible amount of the city independents. These, I call them Cindies, because why not? You've got your Harbottle and Lewis's, you've got your Russell Cooks, you've got your Forsters, your Fladgates, your Maples Teasdales, all sorts of different London firms doing all sorts of different things.
And I think there's also, it's almost a mirror, I think, sort of for anyone who's currently working in one of the very highly pressurized and highly remunerated city environments. This is what your life could have been, or this is what your life could be, even actually, just to sort of understand that there are more choices out there, and there are different models of what makes success and different models of what makes a partnership.
And it's exactly the opposite of what we were just talking with Lucy about with that Paul Hastings slideshow, which is that, you know, that's the expectation at that firm. And if you don't like it, it's okay. You know, it's not, I think there's almost a kind of thing that happens when we have these debates around high expectations at a firm like Paul Hastings, which is we assume that that's the expectations of all law firms on all lawyers. It's not actually. Mm. You can have a very different sort of life as a lawyer. It doesn't have to be, you know, 100-hour weeks, but then also earning the big bucks, you know, where you can still earn lots of big bucks elsewhere. But you know, you can do it in different ways. There's no right way of being a lawyer.
That's completely true. Well, I would just add a note of caution in there. I think a lot of smaller firms fall into the trap of thinking, oh, well, we're much smaller than firm X, therefore our culture is necessarily better. And of course, we can all think of small firms out there which have completely toxic environments. And actually, the smallness and the intimacy of those firms can make it all more difficult if it's like that. But yeah, absolutely. We're finding increasingly firms that are smaller, that can't compete on salary, seriously, seriously looking at actually how they can still attract talent in this market.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Such a good point about culture, Rich, because, you know, there's nothing to say, you know, you can be a top highly remunerated firm and yet have a great working culture. It doesn't necessarily go hand in hand. And I think there's a sort of, you know, there's too easy sort of kind of mapping of those particular characteristics. I think actually, I was at a lunch with an American law firm not that long ago, and they were fascinated by a horizon that I think Jess had written about Harrison Clark Rickabies, which has been hoovering up the low mid-market in the kind of tier slightly below Shoesmiths. And this partner was fascinated because he'd never heard of them before. And I think there's going to be a lot of surprises out there for our listeners and our readers sort of going, oh my God, I had no idea that they were doing these really, really interesting things. And I think it just broadens the horizons of everyone, sort of seeing actually the diversity of kind of models and success within the market.
Completely. And it works both ways too, because I conversely was talking to a managing partner at a much smaller firm, and he was just fascinated by reading about the big American shops who he has no overlap with, but he just wants to find out what they're doing. So there's certainly stuff that, you know, the big firms and the small firms can learn from each other. They really can.
Yeah, 100%. Everyone should read about everyone else, and you should all read it on thelawyer.com.
We'll keep an eye out for a new content that's going to be coming out from Beyond the Bubble, which launches in May. But for now, that's all we have time for on this episode of The Lawyer Podcast.
Thank you for listening. You can contact us at podcast@thelawyer.com. And of course, you can find more about everything and anything we've been discussing at thelawyer.com.
We'll be back again in a fortnight. But until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.